This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Back in the late 1960s, CBS presented a TV special that shocked the nation by telling the story of hungry and malnourished Americans. The Nixon administration and Congress responded by creating safety net programs to help the poor, and they largely worked. Fast forward to today, when millions of Americans run out of food or don't have enough money to buy food for themselves and their families, they are called food insecure. The film A Place at the Table tells the story of three of these Americans, a second grader named Tremonica who lives in rural Mississippi with her mother, a young girl named Rosie who lives with her extended family in Colorado, and Barbie Izquierdo who's raising her two children here in the Philadelphia area. Today on Radio Times, hunger in the land of plenty, what can be done to make sure that everyone has enough to eat. And I have four guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios, including the two directors of this film, Christy Jacobson. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. You were here taking, actually making this film in this studio.
Exactly. So great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us, director Lori Silverbush. Nice to have you with us.
Hey, Marty. Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Mariana Chilton, pretty much a regular guest on Radio Times when we talk about this important issue of hunger. She's an associate professor at Drexel University School of Public Health, the founder of Witness to Hunger. And Mariana, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
I'm glad to be back. Thank you.
Also back with us is Barbara Izquierdo. She is featured in this film. She was living in Philadelphia at that time. She now lives in the Lancaster area, an active participant in Witness to Hunger, and also participated in a number of Witness to Hunger's public awareness programs and campaigns, photography project, and she is featured in this film. And Barbie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. And let me begin with you, Barbie, because I met you when this film was being made, and you were struggling with your two little kids.
Yes.
Struggling to make ends meet, struggling to have enough food to put on the table. How are you doing today?
Today, I am doing great in a way that I never imagined. My life has completely changed. Because of the film, I actually received a scholarship to go to college, a fully paid, the first presidential scholarship to Esperanza College, which is based in the neighborhood where everything began, where they started filming me, so it's great. My life has really changed.
And that was one of your goals, as you were absolutely determined to go to college.
Yes, and the film has brought it to me.
And how are your kids doing?
They're great. They're 5 and 7 now, and they are amazing. I've learned so much through them and the film, and they actually saw it for the first time last night, which was amazing, too.
What did they think about the film?
They loved it. They loved it. They loved watching themselves, and at moments when people laughed, they got kind of upset. They thought they were laughing at them, but, you know, they're still young, but they loved the fact that they saw themselves on the big screen.
Let me ask you about something in the film, and it's towards the end of the film, and we clearly see you struggling to feed your children, and at one point, you start to cry.
Yes.
What were you crying about?
At that moment, in the specific shot in the film, my kids were sharing a can of spaghettis, which in the beginning of the film, I explained how I would never feed them. So I started off with the shame of that, of even having to feed them and being filmed doing something that I said I would never do. And while they were eating that, I was eating a sandwich, and that was all that I had. And it was just so overwhelming, because after that, I had absolutely nothing to give them. I think I said something about a Hot Pocket, which was the only thing that I had an option to give them for the next day, and just the frustration and not knowing what was next and how was I going to make things better and what was going to be their next meal. So it was just the frustration of how can I make things better.
Right. Let me turn to you. First you, Christy, and then to you, Lori. Why did you want to make this film?
Well, actually, Lori came to me with this idea because of an experience that she had with a young girl she was mentoring, which she can tell you about. But for me, as a documentary filmmaker, I sort of, you know, am drawn to telling real stories that tell us something about ourselves. And frankly, very early in the process, we met Dr. Mariana Chilton, and were introduced to the Witnesses to Hunger here in Philadelphia. And also read a great series that was in the Philadelphia Inquirer about food insecurity. But for me, sort of once I started to understand the impact, in particular the devastating and lifelong impact that hunger has on young children, and the fact that so few people know about it, and if they do know about it and are policymakers, they're not doing anything about it. It felt like a subject that I just couldn't walk away from. And of course, you know, filming courageous people like Barbie, you know, and the others in the film is a real honor, and they allowed us to tell their stories themselves.
And I know, Lori, you got into this project because of a young person you were mentoring.
Yeah, I actually was doing like a big sister, little sister mentoring of a young girl whose family was living in a shelter in East Harlem, and she was struggling tremendously in school. And I was able to help her get into a school for kids with learning challenges, a private school, and I was really proud of that. And I thought, okay, we've fixed her, you know, and so we've helped her. And only to get a call from the principal that she was actually foraging in the trash for food. Mm-hmm. This was not a school that offered a free or subsidized breakfast and lunch. And inadvertently, I had helped to make her hungrier because now she wasn't getting the only meals of the day she had been getting at her previous school. And it was shocking and devastating. And, of course, I worked it out to try to help feed her. In the school setting, we brought groceries to the house. And then, you know, the next day, the problem was still there. And the next day, the problem was still there. And, you know, as a thinking person, you have to say, well, why are we not actually looking at the problem? It's great to make yourself feel good because you've reached out to help somebody, but that's not the goal of this, to make ourselves feel good.
Mary, let me turn to you, and I'm thinking actually of that CBS documentary, Hunger in America. I remember seeing that on television back in 1968. Today we talk about food insecurity. Is that a kind of a euphemism for hunger, or does it have a specific kind of meaning for today's world?
I would say both. So food insecurity is a euphemism for hunger, and I think it's perfectly adequate to say, when we're talking about food insecurity, to say hunger in the public sphere. But scientifically, and especially from the United States Department of Agriculture perspective, what the term food insecurity does is get across this experience of anxiety of not having enough money to feed your family and to feed yourself. And that it could mean that today you have enough food, but you're worried about tomorrow. Or it could mean that for 2 weeks out of the month, you're doing all right because you have food stamps or you have enough money, but you could fall off the cliff in the middle of the month and then be very hungry and eating sporadically or eating the same kinds of food. So it has a public health component, and it has this hunger component that most people understand.
And Barbie, that's something that we see with you trying to feed your children, the kind of anxiety that goes along with that, knowing that you're not going to make it through the month.
Yes, and it definitely is something that's very difficult to deal with. And it hurts you as a mother, as a person, just your ego. You don't want to admit that this is something that you're going through. And with a person such as myself, I started with my mother going through this, so it was just a recurring cycle that I wanted to break.
Let me play a scene from A Place at the Table, and this is where we meet Rosie. She's this Colorado fifth grader. She often has to depend on friends and neighbors to feed her and her family, and she has trouble concentrating in school and her grandmother as well. In fact, in this clip, Rosie's grandmother speaks first, and then we'll hear Rosie.
We've got seven people in our family, so you make your food stretch. We've been without vegetables for a while. We do run out of milk. We eat dry cereal.
Grandma.
You know, you have to live the best you can. You've got to make things stretch nowadays. It's not easy.
Sometimes we run out of food, so we try to figure out something. Probably ask friends for food. We get really hungry. And our tummies just growl, and sometimes I feel like I'm going to barf because it feels bad. But I don't really know what to do.
And again, that's a scene from A Place at the Table, and that's Rosie. And I don't know, Christy, to you, Laurie, how did you find Rosie? Because I have to say she is a heroic, frankly, figure. She has great spirit. She seems to be incredibly optimistic and smart. And here she is struggling with food insecurity, as we're describing?
Yeah, I mean, we found Rosie to be all those things and more. And we came to meet Rosie and her family after spending some time in the community of Colborne. As we did finding most of our stories, you know, research and talking to those fighting on the front lines of hunger, we, through an organization called Hunger Free Colorado, found ourselves at the Food Bank of the Rockies, which is in the western slope of Colorado. And there, a young gentleman told us about what was happening in Colborne. He said it's a town where, you know, it seems that everybody in that town is affected in some way by hunger and food insecurity. But there's this really special thing happening there, which is that the community has come together to really work towards removing the shame and stigma associated with that. And we got in a car and we drove through the valley to Colborne and met the wonderful Pastor Bob. And ultimately, through Leslie Nichols, a wonderful teacher in the community, she shared with us the story of Rosie, and we met her and her family.
In fact, we see this teacher going, taking big bags of groceries and dropping them off at people's houses, sometimes surreptitiously, because she felt like maybe they wouldn't want to know that they're getting a food from the food bank. But she also had grown up poor, but was determined to try to figure out how to get food to her children, Laurie.
I think because she had had the experience herself, she knew the signs. And when she has children in her classroom who aren't able to focus and are having a hard time, someone else might just peg them as a behavioral problem, or she started to realize what was going on. And she told us she keeps a couple of granola bars, an apple in her desk, because she's always trying to help kids sort of bridge the gap and perform. A big reason why she brings those food bags around, she knows people's work schedules, and she'll drop it in their cars when they're and they leave the car open, and it's sort of an unspoken agreement, because she wants to kind of spare them the degradation of what so many people in this country face. You know, you have nearly 50 million people in this country who are food insecure, and you know, what does it really say about us as a nation that we actually have people go through this sort of degrading process of having to accept charity food rather than being able to purchase it themselves?
Well, and Mariana, we see her delivering food, but what she admits and feels badly about is that a lot of the food that she delivers, which she's gotten at the food bank, is not particularly healthy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she struggles with this.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think that the there are so many issues that are happening. First of all, I just wanted to piggyback off of this idea that Rosie had a hard time concentrating in school and that the teacher was really trying to make sure that her kids had enough food. Food insecurity is a major public health crisis because it affects child development, it increases hospitalizations, and it certainly has a major impact on school-age children in terms of their school performance. And then for teenagers, it's also related to suicidal ideation. So food insecurity is not simply about not having enough food, but it affects the cognitive, social, and emotional development of children. And really, you cannot rely on the emergency food system to deal with a major public health crisis like this. You need to work with the government systems that we have in place. Those programs are the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which used to be called food stamps or WIC. Those federal programs have a major impact on helping to keep America healthy.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Mariana Chilton. Also with us, Barbara Izquierdo, featured in a film called a documentary called A Place at the Table, and the directors of the film are with us as well, Christy Jacobson and Laurie Silverbush. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Temple University Library support WHYY and invite you to lectures exploring the American idea. The series continues this Thursday, February 21st, with an exploration of Main Street America. Future programs look at women's history, immigration, the poet Walt Whitman, drinking in America, and more. The details are all online at library.temple.edu. These are open to the public with no ticket required. Complete schedule at library.temple.edu.
A lot of books aimed at teen boys are all about adventure, but a new book describes an equally tough journey of self-discovery.
Some boys just know they're gay. Other boys don't know, and then they start discovering that.
We'll tell you about the award-winning novel Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Wistar Institute supports WHYY-FM. I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute. The newest cancer treatments almost always start with a breakthrough in basic science research. Wistar researchers identify the causes of cancer, and this can lead to treatments that directly target the causes without the harmful side effects of older cancer therapies. Basic research saves lives and needs your support. To learn more about how you can join us and help save lives, wistar.org.
This is Radio Times. Excuse me. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. An estimated 50 million people in the U.S., including about 1 in 4 children, are food insecure. That means there are times they don't know when or how they're going to eat their next meal. A film called A Place at the Table was shown at Sundance. It's opening in theaters on March 1st, along with an awareness campaign about what to do about the problem of hunger. Our guests are the filmmakers, Christy Jacobson and Laurie Silverbush, and two local women featured in the film, Barbie Izquierdo, a single mom raising two kids. We see her living in Philadelphia. She now lives out in the Lancaster area. She's also attending college. Also with us, Drexel University's Mariana Chilton is the founder of Witness to Hunger. She's featured in the film as well. Any questions or comments you might have, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Mariana, going back to what you said right before the break about the importance of some of these government programs, and I remember seeing that Hunger in America program on CBS. I also remember working in Appalachia in the summer of 1967 and going into people's kitchens and opening. Many of them didn't have electricity, so looking at their cupboards, and there was nothing there. Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting is after that documentary appeared on television, the Nixon administration, Congress created all sorts of government programs. And as this film says, in many ways, those programs worked. It reduced the amount of hunger and malnutrition.
Oh, absolutely. We almost eradicated food insecurity back in the 70s, and that's because we had a very robust food stamp program. And I'd also have to say that wages were more commensurate with a living wage. And if you think about it now, 80% of the families that are participating in the SNAP program are actually working. And 75% of those families are working full-time. Now, how is it possible that you can have families working full-time and still be, number one, making such a low wage that they're eligible for SNAP benefits and still potentially being food insecure? This doesn't make any sense. So while we need to invest in the food stamp program and in our other nutrition programs, we need to make sure that families are making a living wage. Because, frankly, there's no family that I've spoken with that has a lot of pride in participating in the SNAP program. They would much rather be self-sufficient and be able to make a living wage. And that doesn't mean that there's any shame in receiving SNAP, but we need to really make sure that we think about the underlying issues.
Because, Laurie, in many ways, this is a documentary about poverty. I mean, it's the poverty as people live it today.
I would agree, but I also think ultimately it's a documentary about democracy, because the example that you just brought up was one where citizen activism is what changed things. There was a piece of media, this was very inspirational to Christy and I, seeing that a piece of documentary media impacted the viewing public to such an extent that they picked up the phones and they called their elected officials, and that's why these programs were financed adequately. And that's why Senators Bob Dole and George McGovern reached across party lines and helped to create the modern food safety net. It wouldn't have happened without that citizen outcry. So we think it's very likely, and today we live in the age of social media. Mm-hmm. We live in the age of one click or one text or one tweet away from letting your elected officials know enough is enough. This is not a problem that we don't know how to fix. We actually know what causes hunger, and we know how to fix it. But we need a broad public consensus around it. And that's the goal of this film, to engage people into the democratic process and let their voices be heard, give them a place at the table to end this.
But I wonder whether something has changed in that, however many, 40 years ago, the country was shamed by seeing hungry and malnourished people. But I hear from several of you that poor people today feel ashamed to get government services. And I'm looking back at you, Mariana.
I think that the shame is quite complicated, and I've seen some of those moments in that original documentary, and I think that what George McGovern was talking about when he saw that film, he said that he saw a boy outside of the school cafeteria, and he was asked, "Why aren't you eating with your friends, and how does that make you feel?" And he says, "I don't eat with my friends because I don't have enough money, and it makes me feel ashamed." And then George McGovern says that in that moment, I went back and started to create the modern food stamp program. It wasn't the science And it, yes, it is the public outcry, but it's that sense of shame. And I think that we need to, the shame should not be on those who are experiencing hunger and poverty. The shame should be on our on all of us who are not speaking out on this and who are hiding behind something else, and also shame on our legislators for not taking right. this as a primary issue.
But what I hear from you, Barbie, at least in this film, is some degree of I don't want to say shame, but feeling that you can't care for your children the way you want to.
And that, as a parent, is very, very, very difficult. But I'm very grateful for these programs. It helped me in moments where I had absolutely no other choice but to turn to SNAP and WIC and, you know, things of that nature, because I just couldn't do it on my own. And I was working full time, and at times I wasn't working. And it's just, I learned that to set the right example for your children, you have to be able to put that pride to the side. To be able to literally put food in their mouths, you have to use yours to speak up and fight against something that can be stopped.
Going to back to you, Christy, what I also learned in the film is, I guess, 10, 20, 30 years ago, there were food pantries and food kitchens, probably several hundred of them. Today there are thousands of them, and we meet some of the people doing extraordinary work trying to feed the people in their community.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the really shocking things that we learned in the making of the film, was how vast the network of food banks and food pantries and soup kitchens is today versus where it was in the late 70s, early 80s. And that has a lot to do with the fact that the government was taking responsibility for solving the problem back then, and then slowly began shifting responsibility over to charities and the private sector. And it's simply too big of a problem for charities to handle and solve on their own. There are people doing incredible work, which we've captured in the film. But the hope is that people become aware of the vastness of the problem and the necessity for government to do its part. And one of the things that was happening in the 60s and 70s was the media was placing the blame also on the failings of government with regard to this problem. And I don't think it's doing that now, today.
You want to add to that, Mariana?
No, I'm just nodding. I'm in agreement.
Okay. I'm just reading body language here around the table. Let me play another clip from this documentary called A Place at the Table. And this is where we meet Tremonica. She's a Mississippi second grader. She has asthma and some other health problems, exacerbated in many ways by the kind of empty calories that her working mom can only afford. And here she is being interviewed by a pediatrician. Let's listen.
What grade are you in?
Second.
You're in the second grade? How old are you?
Fixing
to be eight. All right, and you got asthma? Okay, do you ever have problems with shortness of breath when you're outside playing or anything?
I have to stop running and take breath.
Okay. What'd you eat for breakfast this morning?
Didn't eat.
You didn't eat breakfast this morning? Okay. When you get home in the afternoon to eat a snack, what do you eat?
Chips.
What else, baby? What do you drink?
Pops.
Okay. Do you have any other snacks besides chips you could eat?
Cookies.
Kisses?
Cookies.
Cookies and chips. Okay. Maybe you could ask Mom to start buying you some carrots and some celery and maybe some apples. You could slice some apples up. That'd be good.
Again, another scene from A Place at the Table. The film opens on March 1st. It's also going to be downloadable, or I guess available on demand and through iTunes, talking with the two filmmakers, Christy Jacobson and Laurie Silverbush, and also talking with two local women featured in the film, Barbie Izquierdo, a single mom. As we see her in this film, she's raising her children in Philadelphia. She now lives in the Lancaster area, going to college, I should say. Also with us, Drexel University's Mariana Chilton, founder of Witness to Hunger, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. So, Laurie, how'd you find Tremonica?
Well, we knew that we wanted to go back down to a region that had been featured in the 1968 film, which was the Mississippi Delta, and our research showed us sort of an amazing fact. There's a county that was simultaneously the most food insecure in the country and suffering from the highest incidences of obesity. So that was an inherent contradiction that we wanted to explore. We really wanted to give people an understanding of how these two syndromes are flip sides of the same coin. And it was initially kind of challenging because people who do suffer from the health complications of obesity are aware that as a culture, we tend to blame people who are obese and make it a lifestyle choice. Well, you're making bad choices. You're supersizing. You're going for the junk food. And we really wanted to show that choice is a misnomer when you have limited funds and limited access to the right foods to make good choices.
In fact, we see a woman who has I guess a kitchen in her house, and she drives in order to get some fresh foods and fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
She drives some like 60 miles.
Yeah.
I think that's round trip.
And she's lucky she has a car.
She has
you know,
car.
This is an area where not everybody has transportation, as she points out in the film. It's a food desert, a rural food desert, and quite stunningly, it's set in the middle of, you know, a massive agricultural pocket of the country, but the people themselves have access to packaged foods in the stores in their town, or they have to drive at great expense and great time commitment to get some fresh fruit or vegetables.
Barbie, in this film, we see you also taking a couple of buses to go get food for your kids. How hard was that?
Yes, it was hard, especially traveling with two little children, and they both want to run around, and you have to have the patience and just, you know, to begin with the frustration that you have to travel so much, and then when you have to go to the register, knowing that you don't have enough, or your kids might ask you for something such as chips that you know you don't want to give them, and you don't have enough to give them anyway, so you have to brace yourself for that moment to say, well, mommy, you can't get this right now, and, you know, Aiden, you can't do this right now, and just having to explain that to them, and it's hard, it's really hard, but you just have to strive for more and keep going.
But how hard, once you got to the supermarket, did they have the kinds of fruits and vegetables that you wanted, and could you afford them?
Yes, they did, but most of the time I could not afford them. I had to learn early on how to try to make the money stretch, and having to do so doesn't mean that, okay, I have all of my food stamps as the beginning of the month, so I can go and just get whatever I want. I did that in the beginning, and then maybe 2 weeks into the month, I was left with absolutely nothing at all. So I had to learn that maybe if I'm going to get fruits and vegetables, I can only get one, or I have to get something that's less expensive that they might not like too much, but just so maybe later on in the month they can get something else.
Mariana, this film is also about our food policies and what gets government subsidies and what doesn't. And what we learn is that certain crops get government subsidies, and those are the kinds of foods that go into processed foods, whereas the farmers who are making fruits and vegetables generally don't get subsidies.
Mm-hmm. That's very true.
That becomes more expensive.
Mm-hmm. We have a topsy-turvy system that goes throughout the food system. But I want to bring it back to the allotment of the food stamp program, or the SNAP program. A lot of people think, oh, if they've got food stamps, why should they be hungry? Currently, the way that the food stamp allotment is actually calculated, it's much too low in order for people to be able to purchase a healthy diet. And we have found through our research that there's actually no store in Philadelphia where even if a person was receiving the maximum allotment of food stamps, could still purchase a healthy diet. So I mean, it's something that we really need to pay attention to. Yes, we need to look at the subsidies, but we also need to look at the food stamp allotment amount.
And that's been an issue in Congress. President Obama mm-hmm. has talked about it. But what's interesting, even in the film, is you have several different presidents, from Obama, I think, maybe back to Reagan. Everyone says we're going to solve this food hunger problem in America. But here we are with something like 50 million people who are food insecure.
I think it's a good point. I think the problem has gotten worse with just about every administration. So we're not trying to call out one party over the other. There's plenty of people to blame around this. And frankly, there is an opportunity to follow the legislative process. We follow chef and restaurateur Tom Colicchio as he goes down to Washington, D.C. to advocate on behalf of school nutrition programs to have them funded adequately as part of the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Bill of a couple of years ago. And, you know, we were there with our cameras, and we see legislators standing up and saying there's simply nothing more important than the health of our children. And then we pan, and there's row after row of empty seats. Yeah. Mm-hmm. People haven't even shown up to vote. So I think there's a big difference between the rhetoric and the action. And at the end of the day, we need to start to make hunger a voting issue. And we need to start looking at what people are doing, not what they're saying. And one of the great things that we're excited about is that when this film launches on March 1st, we're also launching the first ever National Action Center on Hunger. And we are going to have, as a link from the website, it will give people, first of all, easy ways to engage their politicians and say to them, enough is enough, you need to fix this, with one click or one text. We also are going to be linking to a national policy scorecard so that you can look at exactly how your legislators are doing and how they're voting on this issue and then make your decisions about reelection accordingly.
Chrissy, is as a filmmaker yourself, is it a challenge to get people to go to a movie about hunger?
Well, I hope not.
I know you hope not. I'm just saying.
We have found that audiences who have seen this film are really responding enthusiastically. And what we sought to do as filmmakers is make a film, first and foremost. And we were really fortunate to work with some of the most incredible collaborators, from directors of photography to the extraordinary T-Bone Burnett, who has brought incredible music to lots of films that people go to the cinema to see. So we really sought when we creatively to make a film that would move people. And we also feel that, as was our experience in the making of the film, ultimately we feel very hopeful and very excited and very motivated to be involved ourselves in this greater movement. And we hope and have seen that audiences have been responding the same way.
Because this was at Sundance. But I'm also thinking, Lori, that the film, you're telling people's stories. And I think, rather than hectoring people, stories often can draw people in.
Well, I think stories, I go to the movies to see stories. I mean, I am a political person and I still just want to be engrossed. I want to be riveted by personal stories. And that, I think, is the great strength of this film, is that we allotted the most real estate to people like Barbie Izquierdo, like Tremonica, like Rosie. You could watch these people all day and never be bored. And one of our chief goals as filmmakers was to make sure that they got a chance to tell their own stories, because they could do it much better than we ever could.
Well, and that's kind of what Witness to Hunger is about, right, Marianne?
That's right. I felt like when I'm testifying before Congress, I'm referred to as an expert witness, but it always felt like a sham, because the true experts on hunger in America are those families that are struggling to put food on the table. And there's a lot of wisdom and a lot of savvy out in the neighborhoods in Philadelphia and really across the country that very few of us are really tapping into, and that very rarely get an opportunity to be heard on the Hill and heard in their local city halls and state houses. And that's why we launched Witnesses to Hunger. It's a way to show, have the women themselves show through their own photographs what's happening in their own kitchens and try to teach the rest of the world about how to solve this problem.
We're almost up on a break here, but how frustrated are you, Marianna Chilton?
Well, I guess you can probably tell by the tone.
Well, I can. I've interviewed you enough to know. I sense some, and I think it's an understandable frustration. Yeah. We're talking about 50 million people
right.
in this country.
I mean, the problem, it is so wonderful to be able to have those individual stories to come out, and what I hope we don't do is fall into this trap of thinking, oh, it's an individual problem and it can be solved with just a few individuals. This is a massive public health problem. And, for Barbie Izquierdo is so wonderful, but you've got millions of American families that are still struggling. And there's no opportunity for them to be able to pull out. And we really have to make a much stronger statement about who we are as a country.
That is Marianna Chilton. She's an associate professor, Drexel University School of Public Health, founder of Witness to Hunger. Barbie Izquierdo is with us as well, a participant in Witness to Hunger, both of them featured in a film by our other two guests, Christy Jacobson and Lori Silverbush, the film called A Place at the Table. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY and presents the Summer Academy for High School Students, July 8th through August 2nd. Designed for motivated high school students intent on a fine arts education, the program features college-level courses in drawing, painting, sculpture, and printmaking, and trips to the galleries and museums of Philadelphia, New York, and Washington, D.C. Registration is now open, and space is limited. Details at pafa.edu/summeracademy.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Science geek alert, Eric Lander, who led the effort to map the human genetic code, is now teaching a free online course in biology with all the changes that code brings. Also, why is our definition of rape different from state to state? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
PBH Mind supports WHYY and offers practitioners and professionals in the mental health and wellness arena an opportunity to earn continuing education credits and certificates of advanced training. Access to the experts are courses developed and delivered by leaders from Penn's Department of Psychiatry, whose progressive research is being translated for use in the field. March courses focus on OCD, workplace EAP, weight and eating disorders, and adult ADHD. Info and course catalog at pbhmind.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about hunger and what can be done to make sure that everyone has enough to eat in this country. And I do want to play another clip from this documentary we've been talking about. The documentary is called A Place at the Table. Rosie, whom we met earlier, she's a Colorado fifth grader, talks about how her hunger can distract her and sometimes cause her to daydream about food while she's in class. Let's listen.
I struggle a lot, and most of the time it's because my stomach is really hurting.
So let's take a look.
My teacher tells me to get focused, and she told me to write focus on my little sticker. And every time I look at it, I'm like, oh, I'm supposed to be focusing. I start yawning, then I zone out, and so I'm just looking at the teacher, and I look at her, and all I think about is food. So I have these little visions in my eyes. Sometimes when I look at her, I vision her as a banana, so she goes like a banana, and everybody in the class is like apples or oranges, and then I'm like, oh, great.
That's Rosie from this documentary. We've been talking about A Place at the Table, and Mariana, this is a very creative young girl who imagines her teacher looking like a banana and her classmates looking like apples.
Right.
And she's hungry.
Mm-hmm. What the film shows you and what Rosie teaches us is that there's so much potential and there's so much brilliance.
She's pretty smart.
She's a really
girl.
Bright kid, and she's going to make it. She's going to pull through. But we have to make sure that systematically we're creating the conditions in which all children can reach their potential. The fact that she's sitting in her classroom and imagining everybody as bananas and oranges and apples, I think it would be great if she were actually sitting there and designing something else, developing the next robot, et cetera. Think of all of that imagination and creativity that's right there. And we need to be able to find ways to stimulate it and create the conditions in which no child ever has to suffer from that.
I sometimes ask journalists this question when they're talking about war coverage and seeing people struggling. This is to you, Christy, and to you, Laurie, whether in making this film there was that impulse to save Rosie, you know, to save Tremonica, to sort of intervene in a way that would help the people that you're documenting.
Christy? Yes. I mean, filming throughout the making of this film, there were so many moments where as filmmakers and as human beings, it was quite difficult. The stomach aches that we felt, not from hunger, but from hearing these stories and capturing these stories firsthand. And the impulse, as you said, to, you know, save each one is there. But our hope is that they're sharing their story and us getting the story out there is going to save not just them or help not just them, but help so many people who are enduring this problem. But that was one of the challenges and one that we spent a lot of time talking about.
Laura, you want to add to that? You just rolled your eyes.
Yeah, rolled my eyes in agreement. I mean, we'd be lying if we said that we did not step in and help out at times, and there is a gray zone as documentary filmmakers about that, because some people would argue that you should not try to impact the lives of the people you're portraying, and we did not step in to an extent that their lives were radically changed, but I defy anyone to meet a hungry child and not say, hey, you know what, we're just going to leave a little food behind. But it only spoke to why we were doing this in the first place, because we knew if we left food behind the next day, the problem would still be there.
Yeah. Anything you want to add to that, Barbie? I mean, someone who's in this film and you have these filmmakers filming your life and your children's lives.
in the beginning, it was very scary to allow them to see just how bad the problem was and what an empty fridge literally looks like, and not just the thought of it, to actually open it and show them and just put your head down or look away because you're afraid to see the reaction of these people who you don't know, or anyone's reaction at that. So I was really grateful that they allowed me to tell my story, just so I can show people that it's okay to talk about the problem, just so you can help find a solution and be a part of that solution.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Carol from the Northeast. And Carol, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty. Thank you so much.
You're
and
welcome.
To your guests. I love your show, Marty.
Thanks.
I just wanted to comment. I'm a single parent also. I raise my girls, and I'm first generation to go to college.
Okay.
In between, as your guest was saying, there was time where I was working and times where I lost my job, which happens to be one now. I was working temp, and now the contract ended. As far as food is concerned, I'm glad you guys brought this up because there is absolutely, like, no resources. It's like you go from making $50,000 a year, and then when you come to zero, when you go to apply for these services, and being in the Northeast, I don't know if there's many around me at all. It's kind of hard to find other resources. I find myself having to go back into my old community in the North Philadelphia area at Congreso de Latinos to find assistance and find help. Is there any resources, I guess, available for someone in my position who has a college degree looking for work, but my resources, they're done right now. They're all dried out. I'll take my response off the air.
Well, Carol, I appreciate the call, and I'm sorry, obviously, that you have to deal with this. And I'm glad you're a Congreso, because I think that's a good place for you to have some contact. But I'm looking at Barbie to see if she can help you out.
I smiled when you stated Congreso, because when I was working for the Coalition Against Hunger, I actually spent twice a week there doing food stamp applications and food stamp outreach, which is now the SNAP program. And being as though I worked for the Coalition Against Hunger, I can give you their phone number. They can help you according to your zip code. They can help you find food banks in your area, so you can just go and receive the help that you need. Also, if you want to apply for SNAP, you can call this phone number. They can do the application with you over the phone to save you the trip to going into the office to apply. And that phone number is 215-769-0659 or 215-430-0556.
Carol, thanks for the call to Radio Times.
Thank you, Carol.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And let me see what Brian, looks like Brian from Columbus, New Jersey has to say. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
This subject is right up my alley. I actually work for a New Jersey nonprofit called New Jersey Farmers Against Hunger.
Oh.
I'm actually making deliveries today as we speak.
Really?
Yes, we work directly with farms. We're a food, produce recovery organization, and we pick up produce from farms and deliver it directly to food banks, church pantries, all across the state of New Jersey. So this pertains directly to your last caller.
Absolutely.
She wants resources. I guess I'm calling to let you know about our organization and see if your guests have any other unique organizations that they may have worked with. Last year, there's three of us. We collected about 1.2 million pounds of fresh produce from farms all over the state and deliver that, so we're giving a nice injection of fresh, healthy produce into these food pantries and food banks across the state of New Jersey.
Well, Brian, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I think everyone here appreciates the work that you're trying to do as well. Laura, anything you want to respond?
Yeah, first of all, Brian, thank you so much for calling in and letting us know about New Jersey Farmers Against Hunger. Christy and I met unbelievable individuals just like you who are working around the country to knit together farming communities and the people who most need the food. And thank God for it, because you guys are doing terrific stuff. I know in New York City there's a pilot program that the New York Coalition Against Hunger is behind to try to get farmers together with communities that need it. Michelle Nishan has an organization, a terrific organization called Wholesome Wave, that is working really hard to make sure that people can double the value of their SNAP, their food stamps, when being used at farmers markets. But the thing I would like to say about this, because we get asked a lot in screenings. Well, what about community gardens? What about farming? And first of all, we unfortunately, the limitations of a film, we couldn't show all of these great programs. We wish we could have, but we will be able to go into them at greater depth on the website. And we are going to get in touch with you after this broadcast and make sure that your work is highlighted on the on our website. But also, I think it only underscores the need for a government response, because right now most of these programs are funded privately through grants. People like yourself, Brian, end up having to go out there and apply for. It's time consuming to try to get philanthropic money to keep these types of programs alive. And I think that if we were, as a nation, looking to people like you who have figured out great systems to get food that needs to be consumed by people who need it to them. If this was a matter of policy, you guys would be able to spend a lot more of your time and energy doing exactly what you're doing and not having to go out looking for funds and scraping every year to keep these amazing programs alive. So thank you so much for calling and giving us a chance to talk about that.
Yeah, Brian, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Marianne, in this film, a person featured in the film talks about the nonprofits, the food pantries, the food banks as the, quote, secondary food system for the poor. What does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that there are some fantastic programs, very good quality food that are coming through the emergency food systems, but as you saw in the film, there's also very poor quality food going through the system. And I think that, again, speaks to our very broken food system that we have, the food industry, helping to keep cheap products onto the shelves, and then sometimes literally dumping it at the food banks in order to get it out into the neighborhoods. And I think that we need to make a more comprehensive approach where people can, if they could receive SNAP benefits or WIC benefits, have a lot more choice over the kinds of foods that they could purchase.
And that would go a long way, I guess.
I think people would naturally go towards the healthier foods and would seek out fresh fruits and vegetables, whole grains, low-fat milk, et cetera, and they would have more opportunity to be able to be healthier.
Let me play another clip from the film, then we'll get back to our callers. And this is the documentary we've been talking about, A Place at the Table. And here we meet a police officer who has found that his food just doesn't go as far as it used to. Let's listen.
About a month ago, we had three officers, including myself. However, due to budget constraints, we're now down to just me. It was always kind of a prideful thing that I never needed anybody's help. Unfortunately, I haven't received a pay raise in 4 years. And what I used to spend on a month in groceries now gets me about 2 weeks. I have utilized Pastor Bob's food bank. The way it makes me feel, it's very humiliating. I correct that. It's not humiliating. It's very grounding. The stereotype of food banks is always for the unemployed or the disabled, people that can't go out and get a job. That's not always the case. Sometimes in life you just get to points where you need a little extra help.
And again, another scene from A Place at the Table. And this really underscores the fact that we're talking about, as you were saying, Marianne, at the beginning of the show, in many ways, working people, working poor people.
Exactly. Christy. And you know, one of the things that drew us to the town of Colburn was that so many people were experiencing hunger in that town, and so many of them were also working. And, you know, when you have a police chief in town needing to rely on a food bank, we've got a problem. We've got a huge problem in this country. And I think Mariana spoke really eloquently about it earlier. You know, there are government programs that we need to be adequately funding and also modernizing to meet people's needs, but we also need for people to be who are working to be able to purchase foods on their own.
Let me go back to you, Barbie, because as you said, you're in college now, which has been a lifelong dream for you. What are you studying, and what do you imagine for your future?
I actually start on July 22nd, so I'm still in the application process. I want to study criminal justice, which is something I said when I first came to
the
show.
Is that right?
I want to actually start my own nonprofit organization. I want to teach people how to use their stories and their traumatic experiences in their lives and turn it into something positive, such as what Mariana helped me do in the Witnesses to Hunger program. I want to offer counseling and just things that I think are essential to the communities where I grew up that weren't offered at that time, that didn't give the people that push and that motivation to say, okay, you're going through something, but you can make it and you can get past this with the right direction. I didn't have that. I had to learn that through my experiences, but I would like to help the people that don't have it see that there are other ways of living.
And how did you find Mariana and Witness to Hunger?
Mariana actually found me. I was constantly in the hospital in 2008, 2009. My son has G6PD, which is an immune deficiency. And at that time, I didn't have any heat in the home where I was living in. And my son had a buildup in his eyes, which was causing him to lose his vision. It got to the point where they put him on like a supervisory period where they explained to me they would have to put a needle into his eye to take out everything that was blocking what helps him see. And every time I would go to the hospital, I had some woman that I had no idea who she was just come in and ask me, would you mind taking a survey? And every time I would say no. About the third time that I was approached by this woman was the day that they told me about the surgery that my son would have to go through. And I just couldn't take it anymore. I said yes to answer the questions for this survey just to sort of try to distract my mind on the news that the doctor just gave me. And I ended up telling this person my whole life story. Hmm. And that has brought me here today.
And who was that person? Do you know?
Well, that was, if I could break in here, that was one of our interviewers. We have an ongoing study called Children's Health Watch, where we are we look at the impact of public policy on the health and well-being of really young children. So that was one of our interviewers at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children, mm-hmm. which really hopes to be one of the first hunger-free hospitals in the city. We're really looking forward to that. And it's really thanks to Barbie, we were able to call her back and say, hey, we heard some of your story. Would you like to receive a digital camera and teach the rest of the world about your own experience? And really, after we met Barbie and we saw the photographs that she showed us, I felt like these photographs and her story has to get to the White House. And she's the kind of woman who can really change things.
Well, on that note, we have much more to talk about. My thanks to all four of you. Barbie, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Good luck as well.
Thank you.
Barbie Izquierdo and Mariana Chilton from Drexel University featured in this film called A Place at the Table. It opens March 1st, and two of the filmmakers, the directors, I should say, Christy Jacobson, Laurie Silverbush, joining us today on Radio Times. Thank you very much as well.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're very, very welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. And I should say the film opens March 1st here in Philadelphia at the Ritz 5. You can also see it on demand and check it out on iTunes as well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay with us for Hour 2. We'll be right back.